gets past that.
We're just gonna extend this.
Man in the middle. I'll sit forward. Oh, fantastic.
Look.
Hot mic. Keep them away from each other.
Okay, I think we're ready to do the introductions. For our professionalism session, we have a panel of three speakers. David Wright, ACAS and CFA, heads up analytics in North America for Beach, a global reinsurance intermediary, and also manages the reinsurance sales team in the New York office. David first joined Beach's Toronto office as a college intern in 2003, and Beach was recently acquired by Acrisure, a top 10 U.S. retail agent. Some of you may know David as the host of the Not Unreasonable podcast, a biweekly show exploring insurance and general interest topics with actuary CEOs, authors, and economists. And finally, David recently launched the Not Unprofessional project, notunprofessional.com, dedicated to publishing content to help actuaries earn continuing ed credits, particularly in professionalism topics. Our second speaker, Don Mango, not sure if he needs an introduction, FCAS, CIRA, an experienced insurance executive with a 30-plus years track record of success in reinsurance, ERM, innovation, and insurtech. Don serves as a board advisor for several insurtech companies and accelerators. Don is also an adjunct lecturer in actuarial science at Columbia University School of Professional Studies. Previously, Don served two terms on the CAS board and 4 years as CAS VP of Research and Development. Don is a graduate of Rice University and lives in Gladstone, New Jersey. And last but not least, our third speaker, Todd Ball, is a fellow of the CAS with experience in reinsurance, financial modeling, equity research, and insurtech. His most recent assignment was consulting for a distributed ledger company, exploring opportunities in insurance and reinsurance. Since 99, Todd has primarily worked as an equity analyst covering insurance, reinsurance, broking, and insurtech.
Thank you very much. So the Picasso once said, good artists copy and great artists steal. And what I've done here today is taken a bunch of case studies, mostly adapted from broader financial market kind of ethical problems. A lot of them have been stolen from an email newsletter by a guy named Matt Levine who works for Bloomberg News. And I could just, you know, enthusiastically endorse anything that guy writes is just fascinating.
I was going to say, why don't you just interview him next time?
Maybe I will. but what we're doing today is we're adapting some financial scenarios for the most part to actuarial profession, and I think that a lot of times I think it freshens things up a little bit to sort of say, if an actuary was in this position in another industry, what would you do? Would the code of conduct apply? And how would we react to these situations? A nice way of kind of freshening up the content and analyzing things in light of the precepts. So what I have here is a few slides. I'm going to read them. Apologies, they're kind of long sometimes, but they're setting up case studies and scenarios, and I'll throw them over to my panel for a conversation. If any of you have any comments you'd like to make, please do jump in. It's meant to be interactive and sort of thinking these things through, you know, no wrong answers kind of thing. Except maybe the answer to the first question is lying wrong. Quite an obvious problem here. So let me just read this, and then we can have a chat. So Litvak, this is a person, obviously, who's engaged in lying, was a mortgage bond trader who would buy bonds from one customer, sell them to another customer, and lie to one or both customers about the price he was getting on the other side. In his first trial, he was convicted of a bunch of counts of fraud for doing this, but in the second trial, convicted of fraud for only a single trade. So what's interesting about this, and for those of you who've worked in sales environments, there's a lot of, I don't know if deception is the right word, but a lot of posturing that goes on. In negotiation, you know, you don't ever start with your last deal. And I think that what I want to get at here is that in a negotiation, you're not always telling the whole truth about something. And that is kind of a necessary part, I think, of negotiation. And what's interesting to me about that is it's quite clear that lying is wrong. It is specifically against the precepts. It's prohibited in precept number one. But if you have to do that in order to get the right deal for your client, right? If you're in a negotiation, you kind of do have to mislead people a little bit. And what I'm wondering about, and I'll ask the panelists, is can an actuary engage in a truly adversarial negotiation given the code of conduct? What do you guys think?
Well, when I was thinking about how I'm going to answer these questions, one of the themes I'm going to explore is having been an equity analyst for a long time. I definitely think actuaries need a code of conduct, but financial services outside of insurance need codes of conduct way more than you guys do. And this question is, for an equity analyst, this is absolutely straightforward. I have to lie, without a doubt. I must lie. For example, I write a research report putting a rating on a stock. I have a buy, okay? And then some months later, I'm like, nah, it's good. I'm gonna downgrade it. So I write the report. I haven't published it yet. 3 days maybe before that report gets published. I will meet clients and talk to clients, and they will ask me what my opinion of the stock is. And you know what my opinion is? It's a buy. There are no differences until that report is published, and then suddenly I hate the stock. And clients will then say to you lied to me. And I go, no, you had no right to know what my neutral rating was. It's just straightforward. And yet, tons of analysts on Wall Street have a huge problem with that. And so when that client says to them, so what do you think of the stock? They go, well, I have a buy, but you know. Seriously, this happens. And I'm just like, unethical. The rules are clear. It's a buy until that report is published. And there are numerous examples of this. I'll let Don do one, but I was quite, this is a not academic issue at all in financial services.
So how many of you are involved in the reinsurance submission for your company? Raise your hand. Right? I would argue that involves some degree of partial representation of your situation, true? Right? I know that a lot of actuaries that work in reinsurance brokers feel conflicted. I don't personally think you should. I think how many of you are involved in sales as an actuary? There's a lot of discomfort. Yeah, Chris and I certainly, right? There's a lot of discomfort that sales involves lying. I think you should separate omission from commission. So I think there's a lot of omission and filtering that has to go on. I would argue our closest equivalent to what David's highlighting here would be the perception that you have misrepresented the reserves. Misrepresented. And for those that want to read what I still think is the best work on this, it's by the wonderful Rodney Krebs, and it was one of his last gifts to us before he departed for the mountains outside of Seattle, his 06 forum paper, Management's Best Estimate of Loss Reserves. Fabulous paper, typical Rodney, simple, straightforward, to the point. And what he says is, we need management to articulate to us what he calls a pain function, but think about it as a, what do you want out of my reserve estimate? Right? What do you want? And you have to articulate it and quantify it, and it's got to be applicable to, let's just say, the range of outcomes I have modeled. And then I can tell you what the best estimate is from me based on what you've told me you want out of an estimate. And just simplistically, but I can't do the paper adequate treatment. Think about, for example, if they're like, look, if you see anything suspicious or, you know, any hint that things might be going wrong, I want to know right away. I would tell you, okay, I'm going to give you the 75th percentile or something. You know, I'm going to anything at all, I'm putting that up, or I'm overweighting early responses.
This example is exactly what I was trying to come up with. I was trying to come up with the most unethical but still legal thing I could come up with actually to do. Looking at you, Chris. Or any consultant is, you're a consultant. You're an external advisor to estimating reserves. You could totally take the posture that this company has to know more than I do. They have better data. I'm using some weird model, whatevs. They don't have good tail factors. It is totally reasonable for me to go, if at management, the company's estimate is within my reasonable range, I go, yep, that's fine. And if it's not in the reasonable range, then I go, you know, it's not in the reasonable range here. I mean, is it possible you could scooch it over a little bit to my reasonable range? And if they don't, then those are the 1 in 10, 1 in 20 where you go, eh, can't sign. I would say that is unethical, but totally legal. And what do you do about that? Now, I don't think most people like that, frankly. So I think that's actually an outlier case, but it's totally possible. And that happens a lot, frankly, in other financial services.
We got a comment from the audience here. So the question is, for those who didn't hear, is everything an actuary does subject to the code, or only when an actuary is acting as an actuary do you then subject those acts to the code? You know, if I could just make a quick comment, I'll pass it over to you guys. The code is not totally clear on this, as far as I can tell. You kind of get into the definition of what is an actuarial work product, right? And that's a whole other separate conversation, which maybe we'll get into. And I think the kind of short answer is everything. So I think that depending on how strictly you want to interpret the code of conduct and the body of actuarial education, if you put your designation down on something and somebody knows you're an actuary and they think, so they believe that what you're doing is giving an actuarial opinion, suddenly it's an actuarial opinion. Don, Todd?
Is Samir Kare in the audience by any chance?
No.
Or a colleague of mine? The answer to that question is absolutely no. And I have absolute first-hand knowledge that that is true. That if you're not acting in the capacity of an actuary, you are not subject to the code of conduct.
So what is acting as a...
I know this for an absolute fact.
What is acting in the capacity of an actuary, then? How do you define that?
Again, I know this exactly right. You have to write an actuarial report, and you have to satisfy all the requirements of an actuarial report, which means you have to be able to check data and make sure the data is reasonable. If it's not reasonable, you have to say it's not reasonable, and so on. Equity analysts have no such requirements because we have no expectation that we're going to get reasonable data and that we can check it with management. So you cannot hold us to the standard of an actuary, even if you try.
Don, any thoughts there?
I think the code and the standards are absolutely critical to the reputation we all enjoy in the marketplace. But, and I think, you know, Chris highlighted some stuff, and later when we talk about, let's say, the insurtech world, in order for this profession to grow and thrive and continue, we have got to be able to operate outside of known bounds. And if you want to, I wrote this down this morning on the train. There's no ASOPs for me, okay? With what I'm doing in the last year, there's no ASOPs. Like, hey, advising an insurtech on product development and strategy and my go-to-market. Really? Am I going to wait for the ASOPs on that one? Did I tell them I wrote an actuarial opinion? The fact that I am an actuary is why I get these jobs, why these folks want me and they're using my expertise. But I am not applying it in a manner that is to produce an actuarial work product subject, in my opinion, to the codes and ASOPs. I'm not saying I'm violating the codes and whatnot, I'm saying again, it's the foundation we have. The example I would give to you is if you have a family friend who is a physician and you ask them their opinion of, let's say, eating kale, right? You know, hey, you know, what do you think about kale smoothies? Yeah, good idea. Okay, did they just give you a medical opinion? They're not telling you should take, you know, Prilosec, and you should take that, no, they're not prescribing anything to you. They're using the body of their knowledge and experience to offer you a comment that's in the sphere of your health, right? It's in the sphere, right? If we're operating in the sphere of insurance and risk, I would say that's different than saying, I have signed and I've, you know, written and done a formal work product. I don't know, my opinion, it's a tough one.
Ethics is a higher duty than the law. Right. You have to do more if you want to be ethical.
So I'd like to put this one to Todd here because I want to see if I can introduce some gray area into your fairly black and white pronouncement. So I work at a reinsurance broker, and I have my entire career. And you know, I'm pretty sure I've never issued a single actuarial opinion of any sort. But I do lots of reserve analyses, do lots of pricing analyses, do lots of valuation of portfolios, do lots of things which do make their way into actuarial reports. Is that actuarial work product or not?
Okay, if you're working, okay, one of the other key points I think about an actuarial report is that someone hires you to do it. Whether it's an external explicit hire or if it's management saying, I need you to do this, someone needs to make the actuarial request that I need this report. And once they do that and you are acting in the capacity of the actuary, I think, yeah, then you have to do it to best you can, get the best possible data, check the data, and if the data is just not where you think it should be, you need to show where all the qualifications are. So for example, all you're able to get for some assignment is statutory data, but it still is an insurance request, and I say it's an actual report, then you gotta say, you know, if I can do something with statutory data, not as much as I'd like, and here are gonna be the problems, but I still can give you an estimate, okay? But to my example of an equity research report, no one's asking for that thing. Mm-hmm. We hand that out to clients for free. So it's not.
We're going to get to equity research reports in a second, but so let's just keep beating up on Samir, who's not here, who's a great guy, a friend of mine and Todd's, and so he's an actuary who works as an equity analyst, and What if somebody hired him as part of an equity evaluation to say, let's look at the reserves of an insurance company using their 10K or their Schedule P or whatever it is, and based on that make an inference about the price of the stock? That becomes an actuarial, the actuarial work is intimately bound up in there.
That's I can tell you firsthand, that is not an actuarial report. Right. That is an analysis that equity analyst has with imperfect information that is part of the so-called mosaic. It's the, I can pick data from everywhere, and none of these pieces of data by themselves are absolutely certain, but you put them together and they paint a picture. And that theory is well ensconced in equity research.
Yeah.
And let me, on the reinsurance broking, because this was a lot of brokers hire actuaries from reinsurers, and when you're in a reinsurance pricing actuarial role, in my opinion, or insurance pricing, you are straight up a steward of the capital. You are in a risk control role. We are the risk management function, whether it's explicit, implicitly, we are the risk function. When you move to a broker, personal opinion, not the opinion of any of my former employers or whatever, your job is to be the mock jury for how the reinsurance marketplace will evaluate the submission data. Yeah? So is that an actuarial work product that David is doing? What David should be doing, what actuaries at Aon, Guy Carpenter, Willis, wherever should be doing is saying, if I were in the markets who will be performing an arm's length analysis that they will not disclose to you, right? All they will disclose to you is a quote, which can be anything based on whatever the heck they want it to be based on. No requirement that it be actuarially sound or whatever. What David's job is to do in that regard is to go, here are the ranges, is the way we kind of thought of it, is here's the ranges of what the markets, how the markets might interpret, let's say, your claims experience, you know, for this excess program. Like, you'd like to get this at a price of 10, but in order for that to fly with the markets, they would have to ignore the following, right? They'd have to use this for excess loss development, this for trend, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it would, you know. Mm-hmm. And the mock jury aspect, to me, I think that's a vital, clearly an actuarial work product, and that it takes an actuary to do the data interpretation, but you are not telling them, and I know we're going to touch on this, you are not telling them the price will be, or the price should be, right? Because there's no such thing, right? The price should be, hey, if somebody wants to sell to you for two, knock yourself out, right? It's a legit seller with a rating or whatever, and your management team says, go for it, then who are you? What are you, as an actuary, you're supposed to go, you shouldn't take that quote, you know, write it. Well, what do you care? Anyway. Let's move on to number two.
Next, I was just going to say that. Let's move on to the next one.
Clearly, this session is in time trouble.
Yeah, yeah. The Vatican doesn't like short sellers. So the Vatican put out a report recently which was an economic evaluation of the world, and they took the opportunity to kind of dump all over CDOs and some other financial structures. And so one of the things that I think is interesting, make a really key difference between financial markets and insurance markets, is in financial markets you can kind of take the opposite side of the trade and not necessarily have an insurable interest in the result. And so there's this principle of insurance, which is you have to have an economic loss yourself kind of naturally in order to buy insurance against it. And somebody else, a third party, can't bet on your behalf without having a loss. So they can't short your stock, they can't sell, you know, buy a put option or sell a call option or something like that and profit off of your misfortune. Because then there's, you know, so the Vatican's points go, there's this incentive then to try and do you harm, and then so profit by doing you harm is kind of this moral kind of nasty area. Now, in financial markets, it's very different because you can short stocks, you can buy put options on stocks without actually owning the stock. And what's interesting to me about this is there's this violation of kind of this insurance principle. This is not in the code of conduct, of course, but where this might enter into the analysis by way of the precepts is in the precept one, where it's kind of upholding the reputation of the actuarial profession. And if the actuarial profession is tied up in insurance analysis, and I mean, one of the themes maybe of the prior discussion here was just that if it's insurance work, it's going to be actuarial work, but if it's not insurance work, it's not. And I'm wondering if, you know, how does this, I'm just wondering, maybe asking the guys, how does this interact, this idea of insurance principles with maybe non-insurance kind of transactions? So you can also do ILWs and things which are sort of financially, what do you guys think?
Well, I think you have to carefully define what short selling in insurance would look like, because I don't think it's actually obvious, okay? Let's review. Short selling an asset is selling an asset you don't own. So you borrow it, you sell it in the market, you hope its price goes down, and you buy it back, OK? Okay? Something that is illegal in financial markets that I very much agree with being illegal is so-called naked short selling, where you sell, where you forget to borrow the stock and you sell it anyway. The person agrees that you've sold it, and then if it goes down and you buy it back, it was just a little game you played and you changed the money. That's illegal because that's issuance. You just issued a share of stock without registering it. That's illegal. Okay. Lots of people disagree with that view, but that's what it is. Okay, so selling a share that I don't own. So what would that be? It was the great Stephen Mildenthal who articulated this perfectly in a conversation. He said, I wish I could short sell reinsurance. I wish I could make that company that sold that stupid contract sell more of it. In other words, yeah. If you're going to sell that stupid underpriced contract, short selling is make you sell more of it and eat more loss. I think that would be great.
If I interject there, so because one of the most I think powerful defenses of short selling and these other kind of financial transactions is that they make the market more efficient, and so you can force a price to its more natural level. And the way in which that improves everybody's life is that if the price should be lower or higher, then that's an economically efficient outcome. It's better for the rest of the market to have a proper price on any kind of asset or liability, I guess, in the case of insurance. And so there's that kind of market kind of macro good that merges from the ability to short. And so it's possibly a good thing.
And I'm just saying, in the insurance industry, we have so few mechanisms that way. You know, that's our problem. Although, actually, we have a new mechanism that way, which just showed up last year, the ILS industry, which kind of put it to the reinsurance industry after last year's losses. So that's actually probably good. But we don't have many mechanisms to tell you in real time that you're making a stupid pricing decision. It would be nice if we had something. I don't know if it needs to be short selling, but something would be nice.
Don, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think we have to think about what should be our aspirations for our industry. My opinion is that we should be trying to find the lowest cost home for the risk. That's how we service our principles, if you will, the best, right? Hey, you know, so if there is a sector of the broader market, and this is what's happened with the ILS world, right? The ILS world, which I know Kathy's going to speak on later, the idea is, hey, this catastrophic risk so far, primarily, you know, against the broader portfolios of these huge pension funds, fantastic as far as they're concerned. What are we going to stop it? Are we going to impede it? So somebody could have said, whoa, you have to use a reinsurer and you have to, whoa, we can't do this. Well, I don't know that that's true. If, for example, we could take a chronic, poorly hedged, retained risk by our industry that we wish we didn't have to retain. For example, medium-term medical inflation, 5, 7, 10-year medical inflation. The way you hedge it now essentially is by very expensive casualty reinsurance from a very limited set of markets with high credit risk because it's concentrated and there's a long duration on it, or in worst case you sell it to Berkshire Hathaway or another of a few limited, you know, runoff if it gets to, you know, true disaster. If we could figure a way to offload some portion of that risk, I know our clients would benefit. All carriers would benefit because we could alleviate some of the excess capital we have to carry, therefore possibly lowering the prices, therefore lowering the volatility, improving our ability to filter out the true insurance risk aspect, the signals in the risk that are really ours, that are idiosyncratic to us that we need to retain. If you could say we could unload that risk, but we'd have to unload it into a market that had short selling. Yes or no?
So let me try.
It's like I don't want to call it an evil. I think it's judging. I'm saying that's a necessary component of getting our market and our insureds, the people we're insuring, right? Their price of risk goes down and becomes more predictable. The insurers, we carry less excess capital, less volatility. It's, again, I don't see any of those as like, that's a terrible outcome. No, these are good outcomes. But in order for that to take place, let's say we're creating this liquid market for these specialized securities. Okay. People need to go long short in order for that to exist. You willing to do that, yes or no?
At the same time, I'm going to take the other side because I think we're coming a bit too unanimously on this one. So often, you know, organizations, and personally I'm not sympathetic to this, but they don't like it, particularly if the company being shorted. So suddenly your portfolio looks worse or whatever it is as a result of the market kind of forcing it in a certain direction. And you know, are we just totally dismissing that?
You
sounds like you are, Todd.
You know that CEOs complaining about short sellers is a negative stock indicator.
No doubt. Okay, let's move on to the next one. So disclosure. So this is one of my favorite topics. So
this was good, yeah.
Precept 6 says that you have to disclose. I mean, it goes through all kinds of different ways in which disclosure, I call it the anti-bias section of the precepts. And there's a whole pile of stuff there which tries and remove bias from the precepts. And I'm kind of skeptical about the entire project of removing bias generally, just because I think it's so much more insidious than you think it might be. And I don't think the effect of bias, I mean the presence. Can you see it when it's there? Can you really get rid of it? Can you really be unbiased? So let me read, this is from a few different quotes here. So years of research on anchoring bias by Tversky and Kahneman suggest that once bad advice is out of the bag, there's anchoring that now you can't really undo the thought. It contaminates your thinking. So possible the disclosure can make advisors feel free to give even worse advice. They're saying, well, I disclosed my bias, so now I can go all in. I don't have to even try and be balanced in my advice of what I'm doing. And then now there's this other interesting idea of ideas becoming common knowledge. And humans have a sort of this natural tendency to try and want to agree with each other, particularly if we like each other. And so if you establish a rapport and you say, well, this something is true, there's an urge for people to agree with that and try and find a way to kind of resolve this might be a social tension in a conversation or any kind of interaction and agree with you. And so these are all things that really do counteract kind of any kind of anti-bias measures you make. Thoughts, guys?
I mean, this is the starting point to what I was thinking about. Why does an industry have a code of conduct at all? What industries need codes of conduct? And my answer is the code of conduct is needed if you, in your expert position, could con or fool your customer. That's when you need a code of conduct. And your last two bullets there are exactly what we're getting at here. And there's a huge chasm between active bad faith and kind of, sort of being in good faith, but still optimizing, you know, my take. You know, your example of retail clients and financial services is exactly right. It's probably a dirty fact that no one in financial services wants to admit, but the average human being doesn't need a lot of financial services. They just don't. They need simple insurance, they need simple banking, they need a cheap mortgage, they do not need complicated financial services, and if that's all they need, the financial services industry will make no money out of them. So, what's ethical now? How much can I sell them? How complicated can they be?
How can you be unbiased?
How can you be unbiased? Exactly. Yeah. How can you be? I'll give you here's one. Should the financial advisors take commissions? Okay, because commissions incentivize them to want to sell you more product. So that seems bad. Okay, but if you don't incentivize them to sell you more product, they're going to ignore you. You're going to make no money for them if all you're going to get is a checking account. Nothing. They're not going to pay any attention to you. A commission might make them pay attention to you. I don't know the answer to this. Seriously, that one, I just went, all I can hope is that you're a good person. There's no other answer.
Don?
Yeah. Well, the best disclosure example, my favorite program to watch while I'm on the treadmill at the gym is on at 5 o'clock every weeknight on CNBC. It's called Fast Money. If any of you ever have any thoughts that you want to be a day trader, just watch one episode. In my opinion, you'll be cleared of that misconception. These are animals. Okay? These are the people that are on Wall Street on the other side of these trades, mentally just beyond belief. My favorite is Josh Brown, if you want to look him up. I mean, just, you know, literally whatever this guy says, I'll do. So maybe that's a bad thing. They have what's called the CNBC effect, though, which, you know, Jim Cramer made famous. He's on after them with Mad Money. And now, I guess Jim Cramer's been handcuffed into, he has a nonprofit fund, right, if you will. Anything he recommends, the only position he has in it is in his fund, which goes to nonprofits. But when you watch CNBC now on Fast Money, and one of their analysts is up there, scrolling alongside them is, you know, Josh Brown is long on, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So he's up there pumping up Facebook or whatever, and it says, Josh Brown long, FB. And again, it's coded, so you need to be a skilled person to go, oops, he or she, right? Whoever's on there is telling me this. Is now got the, to me the most obvious one of this in the last few years was how many times Warren Buffett pumped up Wells Fargo during, and it was like no matter what new bad news emerged, Warren Buffett kept going, yeah, that's what happens when you look, right? When you turn the lights on, you see bugs, you know, it's this one of these, and it's like, meantime, it's like Warren Buffett owns 5% of Wells Fargo, you know, it's, you know, so I don't, my personal view on this is there's no such thing as unbiased. There's no such thing as everybody's got an angle.
Just to hammer the point home again, in institutional financial markets, there was a recent court case that says there is no duty of disclosure between competitors. I call you up and I say, I got bonds to sell you. Great, what's wrong with them? Nothing, buy them. There's gotta be something wrong. No, they're great, buy them. Okay, great, fine, stop bugging me. That's it, no duty of disclosure. There are duties of disclosure to retail clients, but they're therefore a pain, so, which is discussed. This is how it works.
And it's interesting. There aren't any, to what I can see, I mean, there are, in this one, there is a precept, actually. One of the sub-precepts does have to do with disclosing any potential conflict of interest. So I guess we do have, as actuaries, duty of disclosure. Next one. But as advice, so pile of text on here, sorry guys. So, but this is kind of a really nuanced point. So I'm actually going to read about this because this has to do with the distinction between a salesperson and a research analyst. So what is research? So one problem with making banks charge for research is what is research? We will talk from time to time about desk commentary, which is a thing where someone at a bank emails a client with a trade idea, but the person at the bank is not a research analyst and the trade idea is not a research report. By the way, this really resonated with me as a reinsurance broker because, you know, back to the original conversation we had there about actuaries being employed at reinsurance brokers advocating for deals with reinsurers. I mean, we're talking very sophisticated counterparties, and so, you know, they can maybe see through some of this, but, you know, there's a lot of bias here. And in the financial markets, they're trying to explicitly deal with this problem in awkward kind of ways, which I'm sure Todd's got a lot to say about. If you're in the business of regulating research, as U.S. regulators have been and European regulators are, then you have to distinguish a salesperson selling an idea from a research analyst selling research. This is not easy, as the ultimate goal of both is to actually get some kind of business done. Everybody has a bias, you know, to Todd's point there a minute ago about we're all in the financial services, we're all trying to sell something to somebody, no matter how disassociated from the original sale you might believe you are, that is the institutional bias. So solicitations from traders looking to pick business up from the buy side will drop significantly as the regulators stipulate that all research must be paid for. Money managers are even taking steps to block emails from those firms that have been dropped from the broker list. And there's a comment from Matt Levine there. He says, it's going to be weird if the only emails that money managers can receive are those that they pay for. Todd?
I can give you some clarification here. Again, there are definitions of what a research analyst and a research report is. So the question here is, how do sales react to this, all right? These are my opinions. I think they're pretty close to what's correct, but this is how I think you go about it. If I have an active research report in a stock and I have a recommendation, sales has no business contradicting that. They could say, you know, I'm not sure I agree with Todd, but it's the firm view and we think it's a buy and here are his reasons, and he has no business imposing his alternative view. If somehow we have an options desk, say, somewhere else, and the options desk has published a report and they don't like the stock from an options standpoint, that salesperson is totally in his right to say the options desk and our fundamental analysts disagree, and here's why. If we don't cover a stock at all, the salesperson has leeway to talk about what they think of that stock, although they better be careful because they might step over the boundary of what is a research report. That's what I think sort of it is. You shouldn't be disagreeing with the report that your firm has written. You've got leeway in the sense of here are some reasons why it might be wrong, although a good research report should say that, why you think you could be wrong. But you've got no business contradicting a research report of your firm. Having said that, salespeople do it all the time, and it's a problem.
So, Don, how about this in reinsurance broking context where a client asks a broker for some kind of actuarial work specifically? I'm thinking an attestation for risk transfer in a reinsurance deal. You know, that might be one. Maybe there are some services that we would bundle in with reinsurance brokerage, my goodness, that will be actuarial work products. I mean, how do you think about that?
Yeah, this is a tough one. I think the problem with I'll differentiate between, let's call them the large footprint brokers, where we do have sort of a barbell population. You have the big three that have, where everybody's either currently a client or recently enough that they're still like a very active prospect. So I know, again, from at least the Guy Carpenter perspective, and I think Aon and Willis were similar. And I struggled to find the exact analogs here, or whatever, because I think what Todd used to do and what the equity analysts do, you know, and Bill Wilt was with Morgan Stanley, but like those were the only, there just weren't that many folks doing this in our space. But when the brokers do it, they talk about the market, right? The market and the industry, because they don't want to go out. Obviously, you don't want to go out, let's say, so one area, Guy Carpenter was tentatively doing some research into the reserve cycle. And when you start seeing that the reserve cycle shows like maybe we're coming out of a period of releases into a period of deficiencies, that's right? It was sort of like, you know, we can do the service to the industry as a whole, but you sure as heck don't want to start naming names, right? Because then you can cross those, the salespeople will call you immediately and go, well, we can cross these following prospects off the list, right? Because you just screwed us over there in your research report by naming their names as.
Here's the nexus for how this applies to actuaries, I think. You're an actuary supporting an underwriter. Your job is to price contracts to the underwriter as best they can. You are a resource for the underwriter, but you're not the last word. The underwriter is the one that's underwriting. Every so often, maybe not so every so often, the underwriter is going to make a call that you think is just dumb. And I really do think there's going to be a giant gray area there of, on the one hand, it's his portfolio, he gets to make that call. On the other hand, you think this is going to mess up your organization. Do you go make an end run to the boss? Hard, hard question. But I think it's within our purview to at least consider it.
All right, let's move on to the next one. Broker predators. So this is another kind of negotiating, interesting negotiating situation where, and this is maybe very financial market focused. But so let's say that you're, and this applies again reinsurance. I think I feel that this is familiar territory for me, where you have a distressed client. Basically, and you have to try and avoid communicating the distress if you can, while still getting an outcome that only a distressed client would need. So in kind of the financial market standpoint, you have a massive load of inventory of bonds or something you're trying to offload, and you want to try and secure a price in the marketplace that isn't too influenced by the amount of inventory which is available. You know, in the reinsurance business, let's say that you've been left in the cold, some market's just pulled off of a treaty, and now you got to try and find a way to get enough capacity together to bring them on, and is that a negative signal that will affect the price of the deal? Perhaps it does. So now you're in the distressed kind of market, creating distressed business. And so I'm wondering about the way that this, I was thinking about this was that there's potentially a confidentiality issue around this affecting the trade. So, you know, materiality standard in an actuarial business, a lot of the time is, would it affect the outcome of a situation? And that defines materiality. And so if there's information which the client doesn't want you to tell them, but would affect the trade, how do you square that? Guys, any thoughts?
This one was really tough. Liquidity requires, a wonderful quote from a guy named Avinash Persaud, who wrote one of the greatest papers I've ever heard in the risk management space about sending the herd off the cliff edge. Look him up if you haven't. But he also said liquidity requires differences of opinion and losers. So I think we don't understand in our world what the term, the order book is. Okay, but the bankers and the traders and the capital market side know full well what the order book is. Liquidity is all about what's called the order book, which is the listing of current unsatisfied bids and asks, right? So bids and asks are, I'm willing to pay X for something, that's a bid, and an ask is, I won't accept less than Y for something, and hopefully we can, you know, you hear about the bid-ask spread and whatever, and that's our job. In the reinsurance broking space, though, that is a tightly managed, opaque, still human executed market. To their credit, Guy Carpenter tried a few years ago with something called GC Rebid, which you can look up, that was an attempt to make a more explicit and open and digital order book. But what David's really highlighting here is what can happen if the order book is what they call coarse, C-O-A-R-S-E, coarse order book, meaning it's got some gaps or there's not enough depth to the market. This is all the underlying dynamics of what liquidity is. So I think the equivalent in our space is somebody wants to buy a really big program, right? We need to place a really big program. What will happen is that you will take away lots of capacity waiting in the bid queue, if you will, and the prices will move only because it's like, well, that got rid of all the lowest price ones, and now it appears to have moved. But it's a spurious kind of movement thing in there. I think, personally, what we should be more concerned about is, thanks to the ILS market, as Todd said, at least in the property cat side, I don't think the market moves anymore. I don't know that this is a problem anymore going forward, and that should concern us more, because what used to happen was we would have pricing cycles, and after a big event, we would recoup lots of our capital losses thanks to the prices moving back up, and what happens now is it goes like this. It never goes back up because lots of new money comes in that just sat on the sideline and goes, ooh, I'll take advantage of that, and boom, now we're gone. So,
all I'm going to add is I thought this was a really difficult one. And In the context of insurance and reinsurance, I guess my view would be I'd kill myself to get all the internal, public, non-confidential data I possibly could, do what I could, and then if I said, this isn't good enough, I'd go to my boss and say, we're in trouble. We're gonna have to do something to quietly breach confidentiality as, you know, as legally, seriously, we gotta be legal. But I mean, I don't see how we can't, the word's gonna leak out. I don't have any wood.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. So what is incompetence? So there's this kind of a few subtle issues going on here. First, the story itself, where which is on the Dell MBO, where Michael Dell took Dell private at $13.75 a share, and there's a judge in Delaware which, after being sued by Dell, they sued Dell and said the price was too low, and so this judge applied some. It was some legal precedent in how to do this and that they could do this, but took some model off the shelf, some cash flow model. This is what a judge did, and built himself a discounted cash flow model and came and said the valuation should have been $3 higher, and then awarded the plaintiff and said you should have raised the price, which to me is kind of this like egregious violation of an efficient market, you know, because they're saying, well, you have a price that investors are agreeing to, you have disassociated counterparties who are saying, yes, what's the price we're going to do? Now some judge turns up and says that price is wrong. And I think that, you know, any time you have the ability to come up with an answer with a price, and that's something that we all do, you have the ability to disagree with something that's occurred. And so how do you judge whether or not you should say something in these kind of situations where you disagree with it? Todd, you mentioned this a bit earlier, something similar.
Okay, well, first of all, this Michael Dell case absolutely infuriated me. But I want to put the context of where this kind of story could be right. First of all, stocks pop all the time from acquisitions. They pop for two reasons, I believe. One is the buying company is going to impose synergies and cost cuts, and they will add value to this transition. Who knows, but the market will listen and go, okay, we believe that. The more subtle one is a stock, which is a publicly traded stock, has liquidity value, and some of that liquidity value actually lowers the price of the stock because the liquidity itself takes up some of the value. When the thing gets bought, the liquidity value is going to go away and the rest of the value is released, okay? So those two things kind of, sort of, directionally justify the pops of acquisitions. This was still ridiculous. The other thing, though, and I think this applies very much to insurance, is what does the efficient market hypothesis mean? And I think this whole idea of the right price is just baloney. What is a right price? Yep. There's no such thing. Yep. The EMH only makes sense if it's testable. And the best phrasing of that I've ever heard is, if you believe a price is wrong, you will have a really difficult time making money assuming that that price is wrong. That's an efficient price. Okay? We have no such efficient market in insurance. It's very easy to make money or lose money by having different views of pricing, and indeed that's exactly how it works.
So maybe we should just define it for a second. So efficient market hypothesis says a price reflects all information. There are different kind of strengths of it, but reflects all of information that can be known about the underlying asset, and so it's right. It's right in a deep economic sense, and if you have a different opinion, you are wrong. opinion.
You're wrong because you won't make any money.
Sure. That's an important distinction to make. So when you disagree with the price that's observed in the marketplace, you're wrong for reasons you might not understand, but you're still wrong, and so your model is incomplete. And then so it comes back to this precept two thing, which is only do things where you know what you're doing. And if you're disagreeing with marketplaces, maybe you don't know what you're doing. Don, what do you think?
I'll use the quote from David Brown, who was CEO of CenterRe when I was there, to Frank Pearson, a great actuary, our chief actuary at the time. And David Brown said, actuaries make terrible underwriters because they're concerned about the right price. Underwriters are concerned about the maximum amount the counterparty is willing to pay, period. I mean, that to me, this is the plaintiff who said, I got undercharged. I don't know why the answer wasn't, well, why'd you agree to sell your stock? Unless it was forced. I don't know how these private going privates work, whether you're forced to sell, but arguably you're like, I don't want $13.50 a share. Great. Knock yourself out, I guess, right? Hold out something, right? Well, how can you sue after the fact? It's like I agreed to it and now I have remorse or something. It just seemed odd. So anyway.
Yeah. Or say, oh yeah, we got a majority of shareholders involved,
Well, the question is, or comment is, isn't this a massive conflict of interest because of all the private information you had? I don't know. Again, I don't know the legalities of, but my view is if you own a piece of stock and they make you an offer and you don't want to sell, I guess I don't see why you couldn't just not sell.
It was a
that's
premium.
That's too low. Yeah, right.
That was what I mean, though. Yeah. Your point is exactly reasonable, but the premium is a pretty big one. we could argue about it, and the other side clearly argued well, so good for them. But that's all I was pointing out, is that it had a pretty big premium, bigger than usual.
So I think we're running low on time. We got a few more minutes, guys. A few more minutes? Okay. Okay, good. Oh, perfect. It's the last one. So this is there's a little bit less commentary on here, because when you don't have data, what do you do? And I think that the door I want to close on you guys, and you guys, is sit on your hands and do nothing. And say, well, I can't do anything, I don't have any data. And there's not really any comparables out there, because this is an innovation, it's an innovative space, and we have no idea. You know, one of the things, Don, you talk about a fair bit is using kind of small sensors and devices to sort of infer kind of what the real exposure is changing underneath, inside of the insurance underwriting process or pricing process. And if you don't have any data, no reference points, how on earth do you know what the right price is? And I think it'd be easy for an actuary to say, well, if I don't have any data, then I can't do anything. But I think that there's some tension here between a business outcome for your employer saying, well, that's nice, but I still need to figure out what to do here. And how do you resolve that? Don, any thoughts?
Yeah. Too many. This is going to be the make or break for us regarding how relevant we are going to be for insurance companies in, I'm going to say, 5 years. Probably, maybe 10. I always tend to overestimate how quickly things will come. But to me, within 5 years' time, Marine is already being transformed. And that's, I think, a proof that the Almighty has a sense of humor, because that's arguably the most backward line of business on the planet, and now is fully sensor-enabled with robots driving the ships and sensors in the cart containers and inland marine, and they track everything, and it's all being made. So the idea of marine insurance, and Tokyo Marine's done a blockchain experiment. I mean, it's over. So it's going to be marine, then aviation, then workers' comp, then GL, then property. So the world is transforming, and if we think we can wait for triangles, you know, we're going to miss the opportunity. So I've personally been involved in helping insurtech innovative companies secure reinsurance capacity, and have had the actuaries on the other side saying, well, you know, there's no loss experience, and have had to say with a straight face to a fellow professional, well, we haven't had a sharing economy for that long. And didn't understand why I needed to explain that fact. You know, they're like, well, how do we know that I need 7 to 10 year triangles before I'm feeling comfortable opining on the predicted loss ratios in this space? And if you know anything about, in my view, the risk and the evolving nature of this, of the business world, if you want to wait until you're sure, the profit opportunity is long gone, okay? So I don't know what your company's risk appetite or risk-reward mindset is, but if we don't jump into this breach and start doing something here, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. So secondly, what Chris outlined for you there, that's what the bankers and the tech people and the money people in the insurtech space think we've been doing for 30 years in reserving. Let me restate that. I mean, state it again. You understand what Chris described is like, hey, someday soon we're going to all start maybe doing this some a little bit. Their view is like, isn't that what reserving is? Isn't that, you don't have this kind of intel on your pricing, reserving, linkage, the whole notion of separating pricing and reserving? They're like, what? And by the way, if you don't have a framework like Chris described, guess what there's so many insurtechs doing right now? They're going after pricing and reserving using anything but what comes in on the application. They could care less about the underwriting application. Their view is like, why would I care about this little tiny bit of information that you get once a year? They're like, oh, casualty? Okay, I'm going to go out and find reams of data from the Bureau of Labor and these underlying data. And I'm just going to build giant data science models, and I don't really care. I don't care if I can explain it. If we can find, you know, it's almost statistical arbitrage. So if you think we can all kind of sip, I'm not giving a big commercial for Chris, but maybe I am. If you think we can all afford to sit back and kind of go like, we're good with triangles, I'm good waiting, I've at least given you two arguments to say, you want to wait, we're going to miss out, and we're going to get smoked, in my view. They're running around us right and left already.
Right, and I think on the more practical level for us, the way to approach that is to just start looking at lots and lots of data that you would not ordinarily start looking at. Buy data sources, look at what the data looks like, try to make comparisons to see if this kind of thing behaves like something you already know. Use those as surrogates. It's not perfect, but and do it all within the precepts. Say what you're doing. Say what assumptions you're making. But that's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to try to build other sorts of models that predict other things and correlate back to losses as best you can. I don't see any other way.
So I think we're out of time, Marina? Yeah, we are. Okay. Thank you very much to the panelists. Thanks, everybody, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.